accession number 28642. Correction, accession number 28637, real one.
That's better. Mrs. Alison Selford, real one. And if I could ask you first of all, Mrs. Selford, to tell me something about your family background. Whereabouts were you born and raised?
I was born in Hendon, Middlesex. My family then moved to Lee-on-Sea out of pure devotion to me because I had tubercular glands, which were supposed to be curable only by living by the seaside. I don't know what the seaside did to the tubercular glands, but I did indeed get better. And my poor mother, who had cut herself off from all her friends in order to live at Lee-on-Sea, did have some reward for it, that it worked anyway. And then I grew up very much cosseted, and I had a little brother, six when I was six, who was pure delight. I was too old to be jealous. It was just a lovely live dolly to play with, and he has been a delight to me and a great comfort and strength ever since. Now, my father was a very well-off civil servant because he was reaching the top of his profession at the Admiralty. He was doing very well. And so why should I be interested in communism? Well, because of the rise of Nazism. My mother had two sisters. One was the famous Rebecca West, and the other was the less famous but far nicer, better and sweeter in every way, Dr. Letitia Fairfield, a Catholic lady, the only Catholic in the family. Well, she was very keen on Austria, all those lovely Catholic peasants. But she took me to Austria when I was 15, that was in 1935. In those days, nobody went anywhere by air, and to get to Austria, we went by way of Germany and stopped in Heidelberg to see the famous university town, which was then, of course, like the rest of Germany, Nazi. And the sheer horror of the Nazi environment, I knew just enough German to read the Nazi papers, and of course I learned a lot more German by going that way. And whereas my father, who was passionately keen on German poetry and even wrote a book on it, it didn't sell many copies, but it's quite a good little book, German Lyric Poetry by Norman MacLeod. But he thought of Germany as the land of Goethe and Heine, and I could not think of it as anything but the land of nightmare. And the horror of seeing a handsome young chap with blonde hair selling us the anti-Semitic rag Der Stürmer remained with me. My aunt bought a copy of Der Stürmer and took it home to show people who thought the Nazis couldn't have be as bad as they were made out to be. There was the proof they were worse. Nobody in England could really take in what was going on there because people didn't travel in those days very much. Unless they went abroad as members of the armed forces, the vast majority of the working classes had never been out of England.
During this visit, did you go to Germany as well as Austria then?
Austria by way of Germany. We had to stop somewhere. I think on the way back we stopped in Munich, which was equally horrible, of course. So we went across the border into Austria and found that a great many of those lovable peasants were longing for the Germans to come and take over. And they were all passionate Nazis, though they kept a little bit quiet about it when the English tourists were listening. But Austria was then a great tourist destination. It was very cheap for English people, and it had its famous hotels all arranged for the English. All the hotels had been there in the days of the Austrian Empire, and they were quite used to putting people up and were quite good at it. And of course the food in Austria was marvellous. For us, not for the Austrians.
Could I ask you at this stage about your education? Because being an ill child, you know, the fact that you hadn't been well, did you go to school?
Oh, yes, yes, but not till I was six. I learned at my mother's knee to read and write. But I think I was... No, I must have been 5 and a half, I think, because I was at school, certainly, when my brother was born. And my mother was a bit worried about whether I should go to school, but I did. I went to a little private school, and then I went to Westcliff High School for girls. My mother had been for a time at the great boarding school for girls at Cheltenham, and the experience had been so terrible she would vowed never to send a child of hers to a boarding school.
How about your Aunt Rebecca West? Did you see much of her?
Oh, well, she wasn't a cuddly and lovable aunt like my Aunt Letitia. Aunt Letitia was lovely, and lovely to my daughters too in time. She was kind and good. She was a bit bossy. And Rebecca, who was nearly 8 years younger, resented this very much and put terrible caricatures of Letty into her novels. And in her there is one short story in which a lady based on Letty is murdered by her husband because of her habit of interfering with everybody. But this is not to be relied on. It was her job to be bossy. She was against great odds. She had managed to go to medical school when she was young, become a doctor, and she was in charge of inspecting the hospitals then run by the old London County Council. And clearly it was her job to tell them if they weren't looking after the patients properly. You expect bossiness in the job. Yes. I know I heard about one hospital where somebody had died when they shouldn't have, and the London County Council was sending an inspector round to find out what had happened, and one of the doctors was heard to remark, if they send Dr. Fairfield here, she'll be down in the boiler room asking the boiler man what he was doing at the time. She had that reputation for extreme thoroughness. Well, all right, she was bossy, and it was her job, and she had strict views on how children should be brought up. But she was kind and good and loving to children. We all adored her.
Well, I've rather interrupted your flow about, you know, your experience of Nazi Germany.
Yes.
And I imagine that this is somehow linked with your attraction to communism.
Oh, it was, yes.
What did you know at this time about the Soviet Union and communism?
Oh, nobody knew very much at all. Those disgusting people, the Webbs, went to Russia and spent the whole time in an office with a British communist who fed them totally bogus statistics, which they turned into their great two-volume work, Soviet Communism, A New Civilization. And it was all complete rubbish from beginning to end, of course. But then, you see, nobody knew that. Russian is a difficult language. People didn't learn it. And wasn't taught in any school then. But whereas we did learn German at school, and we could see what was happening in Germany. When I came back from Germany, I joined the Labour League of Youth, which you might think was a harmless thing to do. But in those days, the Labour League of Youth was totally in the hands of communists. The Labour Party got very upset about it later on and tried to do something about it. But at the time I joined, it was practically solid communist. And I remember the first meeting I went to, we sent a resolution of protest about the fact that our government was selling arms to both sides in the war between Bolivia and Paraguay. I bet you didn't know there was a war between Bolivia and Paraguay. No, nobody remembers it except me. It was in 1935. In fact, some 50 years after that, I met a very nice old lady Conservative MP, Thelma Cazalet, who had then retired. And she said, in 1935, there was a war between two South American countries, Bolivia and Paraguay, I said instantly and automatically. And she'd forgotten who they were. And
so that would have been your first protest, would it?
Oh, yeah. And she said when she was a Conservative MP, the other Conservative MPs laughed at her because she thought it wrong that Britain should be selling arms to both sides. And I said that was what I was protesting about. So we had a great deal in common, Thelma Cazalet and I. Nice old lady.
I suppose at this time as well, Mrs. Selford, this would have been the years of the Depression, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, of course. Labour League of Youth people used to tell me to go and look at the conditions of the unemployed in Southend, which, of course, as in any seaside town, were terrible. People just took it for granted there was no work in the winter, and there were queues outside the unemployment exchanges, and it was a very, very depressing scene. And of course it spread to our school because people went for the safe job that paid a pension, not the thing they wanted to do. And this meant that anything at all precarious, like art, was considered a very foolish thing to take up. Well, of course, I couldn't be told, could I? As soon as I insisted on leaving school at 16 and going to an art school, the South End School of Art at first, which was quite a good school, one of its alumni, who became quite well known as a reconstructor of historical scenes. If you go to, say, Harlech Castle or anywhere or in the country, you find a reconstruction of the scene drawn by Alan Sorrell. He was one of the people who'd graduated from the Southend School of Art. Well, when I was 17, Letty took me to Austria. Again, remember, Austria was still independent. It still wasn't German.
Yes, this would have been 1937, wouldn't
this
it?
This was 37, yes. And it was even more horrible than before, of course, going through Germany. This time we did more know what to expect. And it was gruesome and terrible. By the way, on the first trip to Germany, 1935, my aunt took along a little girl she thought would be a nice friend for me. She wasn't a particularly nice friend for me because she was a bit too young for me. She was then 13. A girl called Moira McEntee, the daughter of Seamus McEntee, who was a minister of in the Irish government then. Well, Moira McEntee, although she was only 13, reacted exactly as I did to the fascists, to the Nazi, sight of Nazi Germany. And quite recently, she was in the Irish Writers Organization, whose name I forget. She's quite a famous Gaelic poet in Ireland. I'm afraid the merits of her poetry must be forever lost to me. I am not going to learn Irish Gaelic, not even for Moira's sake. But Moira was in this organization, and they were planning to give a pension or some recognition to an Irish writer whose main claim to fame was that he worked for the Nazis during the war. And they all thought this was just a lovable eccentricity on the part of an Irish boy. Moira thought otherwise and stormed out of the writers' organization. And it was all because of this trip when she was 13. And I got in touch with Moira again after not seeing her for many years. I got in touch with her and went over to see her in Ireland. She's still alive, I'm happy to say.
What were the main differences you noted going back in 1937, from the 35 trip, in Austria and Germany?
We still had to go through Germany. And and as I say, it was more horrible than ever. And I still had the awful difficulty, because of this, I had the awful difficulties with the German language. I could not get fond of speaking German. I mean, I still can speak German to the degree I am not at a loss if I have to order a meal in Germany, but it's no pleasure to me, and I've never been able to take any pleasure in German literature, which is perhaps my great loss, but it all seems to me so painfully obvious. But
were there any sort of, in Austria in particular, were there any overt signs of Nazism?
Oh, yes. It was then officially discouraged, you see, but people would, in conversation, express their wish that the Germans would come in and take over. And we were horrified by the conversations we had. And my Aunt Letty's German was, if possible, worse than mine, because she didn't have any gift for languages. She had many great gifts, but she wasn't terribly bright with languages. And as I say, my father's German was of a literary character. He wasn't with us on this trip, or he would have done the ordering and the everyday things. But it's amazing how little German I did learn. I learned much more later on through having an Austrian refugee landlady, and I learned how to curse and swear in German by listening to what she and her husband said to each other.
Very useful. By this time, you know, when you went back in 37, yes, were you then a member of the Communist Party?
No, not then. I had great misgivings about it. I must do myself that amount of credit. I thought poorly of their attitude to free speech, which they seemed to be in favour of when it was freedom for them. And I, generally speaking, I was not by any means convinced by the communists I met. And then we moved back to London because Leoncy was really too boring for a growing girl. And I went to anywhere I wanted to go to a better art school. I went to the Central School of Arts and Crafts, which I think is still in the same place, the top of Kingsway. I don't know, Southampton Row. It was very interesting there. I think the most interesting thing that happened there was that a tutor got us illustrating Orlando by Virginia Woolf, and he got Virginia Woolf to come along one lunchtime and give us a little talk about why she had written Orlando. That really was fascinating. She came along with her husband, Leonard Woolf, the publisher, and I loved him dearly, of course, without ever having seen him, because he was the only publisher who would accept my daddy's book on German lyric poetry, see. So I was all for him. And he sat very close to her the whole time she was speaking. They were both very thin. The two of them, as they sat together, took up about the same room as one normal person. And I don't mean a fat person like me, I mean anybody. And they were deathly thin. I didn't know then that he stuck close to her because he was afraid she would go out of her mind. But this was in fact the case. But she was very interesting about why she had written Orlando. She said she wanted to make a portrait in words of her friend Vita Sackville-West. And she was restricted, she said, by the fact that Vita Sackville-West was a woman. She wanted to show what she would have been like as a man. And so the character changes sex in the middle. And there's Orlando is famous for this. You know, he's reincarnated as a woman and then reincarnated again. And it confused the readers considerably. But she explained to us why she'd done it, which I was very interested to listen to. And I'm sorry I didn't take any notes at the time. It's always stuck in my memory. She looked very, very, very insubstantial, as if she was about to fade away, poor lady. But not then suicidal. I think she was full of beans, in fact. That was very, very sad that she killed herself, wasn't it? But anyway, I was thrilled to see her. And
what was going on at this time with the League, you know, that you belonged to?
I wasn't still in the Labour League of Youth. No, I was fascinated with Unity Theatre. Now, Unity Theatre, which Scott really only was in its glory for a little over a year, it started showing what it described as living newspapers. It was an idea which came from the American left-wingers of New York. You put on, you dramatized current events. And they did one which caused a great sensation, which I didn't see, called Busman, all about a bus strike. And then they put on various plays nobody else would put on. And I was absolutely fascinated by it. I went along to see what was happening. And the first person I met was a funny man with a squeaky voice called Wilfred White, who said, oh, the meeting you've come to, it was a meeting of people who wanted to write plays, that's right. He said, the meeting isn't here, it's at our other premises in Britannia Street. And to save a penny on the bus, we walked there, you see. And this was, Unity Theatre was about half a mile north of King's Cross, and the other premises were a little bit south of King's Cross in Britannia Street. So we went to this old chapel in Britannia Street, and Wilfred talking all the time. I was thrilled with Wilfred's conversation. I so seldom met people who talked like this. He was expounding world history to me, of course in a Marxist way, but he had thought about it, and he had a theory that if a country was wedded to an old feudal way of doing things, it was bound to be defeated by any country which had adopted the bourgeois way of doing things, and consequently you couldn't expect France under Louis XIV to win its wars against England, which was already a bourgeois state, or anyway, according to the Marxists, it was. So Wilfred was explaining this sort of thing to me with tremendous verve and interest, and he remained a friend to the end of his life.
End of Veal One, Mrs. Alison Silford.